Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Hurricane Harvey, Irma, massive fires. What do disasters reveal about social order and what needs to be done to save lives? And first, hacking, fake news, and paid trolls, both from within the country and from afar. Are they destroying democracy? We are joined by Jennifer Forstall, who's a professor of political science at Stockton University, and by Chris Tenove. He's a postdoctoral research fellow at the Center for Ethics and the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you here with us. You both look at a type of threat to democratic processes: hacking, trolling, fake news, sort of corrupted information. So maybe the place to start in a conversation like this is, why are these threats to democracy? What is it that we need in democracy in terms of information, in terms of deliberation, for it to function properly and to maintain it? Chris Tenove, do you want to start?
I'd love to. And that's a great question and exactly the one I've been thinking about. We're learning so much about what happened in terms of what bots were promoting what messages, what kinds of fake news stories were circulated, but we still don't really know their effects. And I think we don't know how to talk about what they're doing to our democracy. So the former CIA acting director, Michael Moore, described these kinds of digital interference as, it's an attack on our democracy, it's an attack on who we are as a people. And I do think we need to think about all the ways in which that might be true. So the way that I am thinking about this is to use one, this is an analogy, but thinking about democracy as people coming to a table. They get a spot at that table in order to vote. That's one way they contribute, but also to advance their views in public discussions, protest, join a civil society group. So there are lots of ways we can get to that table. And then once we're there, we need a kind of conversation that allows, if we don't come to agreement, at least we agree about some basic facts, we agree about what matters, we find out where we can find some overlap in what we want, we identify differences, and we gain a certain sort of trust and respect for each other, or try and maintain it. And then we have to get up from that table and act on that discussion. And so in each of these three sort of phases of democracy, we can see that there's been challenges posed by the different digital techniques that foreign actors and domestic actors have been using.
Like the hacking and like the trolling and the fake news, that sort of a thing.
Precisely.
Yeah, and just the incivility in general, I would think, is part of it as well. Mm-hmm. Jennifer Forstall, what would you add?
So I think a lot of what Chris has said is right on the money. You know, we know that a lot of what we need to make democracy work is not only the sort of good information, we need to be able to identify the things that we need to talk about at that table. We need to know who those people are with that are talking with us. We need to know how to talk to one another to get back to the civility thing. You know, where I come from, which is a little bit different, is thinking about not only sort of how that table might be changing and who the actors are, but also, right, how the table is designed. And so a lot of what these digital technologies are introducing into the conversation is a whole new way of organizing people and publics. And so it's not just sort of the kind of information that we need to be looking at. We also need to be looking at how that information and why that information is being spread the way that it is, sort of how these technologies are bringing us together in new
or not bringing us together, I think,
right,
in many cases.
Exactly, how they are organizing or perhaps disorganizing the public.
Dividing in many ways rather than sharing a table, having disparate tables perhaps.
Right, and in some cases, you know, the thing about digital technologies that is not the case in physical space is that you don't often see the table for what it is, right? So many, like there are 2 billion people on Facebook, but you know, we don't all recognize that we're sitting in the same space. We're sort of in, you know, alternate dimensions where we can all see, you know, we're all there, but like we're in different phases of existence, and so we don't really see each other in the same way.
So let's talk about some of these phenomena that you two have been looking at. Maybe we should start with the hacking, because the hacking is done for multiple reasons. Talk yeah. us through some of these reasons.
Right. So there are different ways to use this word hacking, for starters. People in the digital technology world often use it in a positive way. You work on a hack of your system in order to get it to do something better or do something different. And that's worth thinking about. Another way is we use hacking just if it has anything to do with an online technology and there's a problem, we call it hacking. So for me, hacking I use more specifically, at least in the negative context, is system intrusions, usually to access data that people aren't supposed to. And so the most prominent cases we saw in the recent election were the hacking of the Democratic National Committee's communications and the hacking of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, John Podesta's, his email and communications. And so on the one hand, so this is a clear legal violation of privacy of data, and that's a bad thing to do in election. But it's not just about, you know, breaking and entering. It's very important is the way those hacks were used. They were very strategically rolled out to maximize attention to them instead of other issues that maybe warranted, you know, greater discussion and action after the election. They were leveraged to sow the greatest distrust possible around some of the people involved, particularly in the, for people of a certain political persuasion. And so it's not just the system intrusion, it's very much that this hacking and getting at people's private data is then used in these ways to undermine, again, the quality of conversation, the ability to talk about other issues.
And the ability to talk across the table at all. And this is hypothesized to have been done by Russians. Do we know this to be true yet?
I think we can be pretty confident, although some of the most conclusive data is not public, or some of the final pieces of the puzzle. So by that I mean there's a lot of things in the way that the system intrusion happened and the way that, so technically that it happened, that indicated these Russia-linked groups. The alignment with an overall policy of Russia around the election, around information warfare is maybe strong, but at least information interference, consistent. And then some of the other key information, which we don't know, but we get assurances from intelligence agencies, is some of that more human intelligence and finding out, yes, we have evidence, more specific evidence about orders given or who actually asked for what. But the thing that's so tricky about these things is that there can be different people in this chain. The person who achieves the exploit of a system isn't necessarily the person doing the leaking. Right? And so is it possible some are not Russian affiliated? I think, you know, that's possible. Moreover, and again, this is how I mentioned before about how it's domestic and foreign actors, and they often are kind of working together. So when Donald Trump, for instance, says, please hack Hillary's emails, calling for Russian hackers to do so, I mean, that's a very obvious and public way, but there are a lot of ways in which there was a willing domestic constituency to take this information when they get it and advance it. And so, yes, I think it's pretty clear there was a significant contribution of Russian or Russian-supported actors, but it's certainly not them by themselves.
Now, in your paper, you suggested this is not altogether new. It's just kind of risen to a new level and in multiple countries.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how pervasive are we talking about?
Information insecurity is absolutely pervasive. We know this from the phenomenal numbers of cybercrime. So data is getting access and use all the time. In fact, most hacks of political groups are probably not leaked because there's huge amounts of state espionage and following each other's conversations that they use in strategic ways but would never leak. The leak of these big parts of documents is fairly new. There's some really good research by a group out of Oxford called the Computational Propaganda Team that has looked at how bots are used in, I think, 10 different countries, from Poland to Taiwan to Canada, where I'm from, to the United States. And so we get a pretty good picture, first of all, that's pervasive because these digital platforms are there to be gamed. They have these vulnerabilities. But it is used in different ways. And we can also see that different countries are vulnerable in different ways. So I'll just say one little thing about the French election, which is an interesting comparison to the US one. There was a very prominent, again, leak of hacked documents called the Macron leaks, because at that time, presidential candidate Emmanuel Macron was about to begin the, it was the second round of presidential elections when this came out. And it was a strange leak in a way, because it was a huge amount of information. It wasn't actually that much about Macron. There was deliberately introduced falsehoods about Macron in it. So it wasn't revealing necessarily like a big truth. It was doctoring these things and then pretending they were true in order to leverage them. Another thing that's interesting about it is a lot of the bots that were promoting attention to it on Twitter were the same accounts that were being used to promote pro-Trump messaging in the US elections. And they were very ineffective. Partly is the timing, and there was a media blackout then, right before the French election. Partly, a lot of them were writing apparently in English, and so not necessarily persuasive to a French voter. And partly a different political culture, where parties or groups within France may not have been as keen to jump on illegal activity and use it for electoral advantage.
You know, in your paper here at APSHA, you also mentioned issues like self-determination and sovereignty and how these are now at threat too.
I think they are in a few ways. So most basically, you can't think of the citizens of a country as being self-determining if one of the most important acts, which is to decide their government, is interfered in and no longer seen as legitimate by many of the citizens for that result. We don't really know that the outcome would have been different barring foreign actor involvement in the US one, but it certainly has lowered the trust and legitimacy of that. So that's a clear interference of sovereignty. International law struggles to characterize that and provide opportunities to take action on it at the international level, and that's a problem. That's a difficult thing to deal with. But in addition to that, there's things like if a country wants to structure the conversations that people are having within their country, want to develop laws to regulate it, and then a foreign-owned social media company doesn't enforce hate speech laws at the right time or in alignment with what the country wants, you can say that those people aren't able to really be self-determining, democratic citizenry using the processes they want, that they've decided for themselves, because decisions about how they will talk to each other are being regulated elsewhere or decided elsewhere.
Jennifer Forrestal, let's bring you in now. You've been focusing on the proliferation of fake news and the trolling, and how do you see that as within this conversation of, oh my God, what's happening with democracy?
Sure. So again, I'm sort of going to jump off of a lot of the things that Chris says, because what I think that he's pointing to, particularly with a really interesting comparison between France and the United States, right, is that it's more than just the strategies that people are using, and it's more than just the technologies themselves that are available. It's also sort of this, especially this comparison, sort of forces us to look at the wider social and political sort of culture, I think is the word you used, that, you know, gives us a context within which propaganda, misinformation, disinformation either works or is successful or isn't, right? And again, as I think you opened the segment, this isn't new, right? Harold Laswell wrote in like 1927 with regards to the First World War that, you know, propaganda isn't about being a good PR person. It's about taking advantage of a disorganized public, right? A bunch of citizens that don't understand how they're connected with one another, that don't have those ties of trust and reciprocity, solidarity. And so, you know, when we think about what to do about this, right? Like, what does democracy mean in a digital age? A lot of that is sort of how do we build sites and spaces that can sort of recapture or support and maintain those kinds of relationships that give sort of grounding to the hard work of democratic politics, right? How can we make sure that people's ties between citizens aren't totally disrupted with, you know, bad news or sort of things that make you sad that, you know, don't get people running off of Facebook, which happened in the wake of the 2016 election, right? Like, how do we keep people at the table? And so these are sort of questions that I think these problems open up that go beyond just like, we need better information out there.
Okay, so what about the paid end of this? So how do you deal with that? For example, the paid trolls. Both of you have sort of mentioned trolling, and many of them are on somebody's payroll, whether it's a foreign country or a local political operative. So, and before you even do that, also be thinking, we talked earlier about, well, what is the effect of trolling? Maybe you should talk about that first.
Sure. So trolling, in my understanding of it, and this is controversial, there's a million different ways that you can define trolling. And a woman named Whitney Phillips does really great work in this area, so everyone should go read her stuff. But the way that I understand trolling from a particularly political perspective is that it's a particular kind of activity that you engage in with the intention of sort of shutting down a conversation. So democracies need people to continue to want to be at the table, right? The whole idea of democracy is that even when you lose, you'll come back to play again and hope to win another day. And trolls aren't interested in that. And so, you know, paid trolling is a little bit different because they don't seem to have that kind of personal investment. But there are a lot of things that we can do and that we've seen be successful in, again, building tighter knit communities online that can sort of insulate themselves from trolls so that when the like wrecking ball of a troll comes through and tries to spread hatred or misinformation or death threats in the worst case scenario for women, mostly women of color, then they can sort of heal and protect themselves and say, like, that's not acceptable in this space. And so, there's a lot of other better research on this that sort of does the actual strategies, but a lot of them are things like moderation, sort of posting the rules and making it clear that, you know, that is not how we comport ourselves in this space. But all of that goes back to thinking about these as more than just sort of bland, you know, internet tubes that send information without any kind of bias or whatever, right? Like these sites are designed in specific ways. And if citizens are actually going to be sort of the whole democratic citizens taking responsibility for the facets of their lives that affect them, we need to start thinking more seriously about how those sites are constructed and the kinds of communities we want.
Yeah.
Just to add one thing that Jenny presented this week, and that's so smart in her approach to this, is to point out that there are two very broad ways of going about making these spaces better. One is to look at the issues around gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the concern is that conventional journalism and its ethics of professionalism and ability to investigate and disseminate news is being undermined. So we might want to support more of that. We might want to have social media sites doing like a tougher job of regulating what is aggressive or hateful conversation on their sites. We might want them to flag things that are not from where they appear to be. So there's a lot of things that we would ask people to do in the design of the table we're at. Mm-hmm. And then, but Jenny's additional point is, let's not think that's the only answer, because if we do that, then we're surrendering our conversation to these gatekeepers in some way. And so we have to also make sure that citizens themselves are engaging this conversation about how we should be speaking with each other, that I imagine that they're trying out different ways of doing things, and that we're cultivating among citizens some of these, you might call it the ethics or just basic respect or civility, you know, different terms for it, but ways of engaging with fellow citizens so that we don't need to be regulated, that some of it is bubbling up.
Mm. Yeah, so yes, thanks. That's exactly what I'm arguing. But
that's exactly what you said earlier.
Yeah, that's exactly what I presented on Thursday.
He was listening.
But yeah, so and part of that, right, a big part of that is that when we tend to focus on the problem of misinformation, we focus on the facts. And this was a huge part of our conversation on Thursday, right, is truth and not truth and facts and lies. But facts are really only part of the story, as I imagine any good journalist will tell you. Presentation of those facts makes a whole big difference, right? And the audience that you're playing to. And again, sort of thinking about how we cultivate those norms of discourse that teach you how to present facts in a compelling way. And, you know, that again means that we can't allow elites to do that for us, right? The gatekeeping is not enough if we want the sort of robust democracy that I think many of us do.
So you're both quite optimistic about the possibilities.
Maybe.
Optimistic is strong. I would say optimistic that there are opportunities. It's not the right response to say, now that the internet is here, we are unable to agree on truth and foreign actors will have their way with our elections.
Right.
That's absolutely not true. On the other hand, there's a lot of difficult things that need to be done and innovations that are needed in order to address these issues.
So I wonder too, when you've got all of these simultaneous threats that are coming from technology, really information technology, and then at the head of a country like the United States, you have a guy like Donald Trump who is then adding to it with his own disinformation, mm-hmm. and simultaneously attacks on traditional journalism as fake news. Granted, they're not perfect and they make a lot of mistakes and they're kind of narrow in their perspective, but at least they try to fact check. These are big problems. And yeah. when I speak with, you know, average voters who may have been engaged, they're like, we don't know what to believe. They throw their hands up in the air like, what do we do? What's your response, Jennifer?
Oh, man. I think that's a good question, right? And it's clearly, again, one that we've been grappling with for at least 100 years, right? Like, again, I'm a political theorist. I study the history of political thought. And this is a problem that, like, at least dates back to the early 20th century. With the guys I'm reading, it definitely dates back millennia, right? Like, this is just a problem of politics. These sites are here to stay. And so in some cases, I don't know that optimism or pessimism is the way to go. And it's just sort of like, what can we do to use them to make people feel less that way, less hopeless and disorganized? And again, the strategy that I am taking as my small part of that scholarly endeavor is to think about how we can design Facebook better, how we can design Twitter better, right? So I don't think it's a coincidence that disinformation spreads particularly fast on Twitter and spread very quickly on Facebook, not only because they're widely used, but also because of the structure of those sites, right? And, Facebook, I think, realized that after 2016 and is thinking more about their sort of obligation or responsibility to the public. And I think, you know, there's a lot that we then can do as experts in this to help them with that conversation, so.
And I'd just say that there are vicious circles, but also virtuous circles possible in this area. Mm-hmm. So the vicious circle that I've been looking at is there are these vulnerabilities in our politics and how we communicate online and the digital technologies more broadly that foreign actors are taking advantage of and making us more distrustful of each other, of the truths that we put forward and so on. And that then sort of incentivizes domestic actors and parties and politicians to continue to act as badly and take advantage of it. But the virtuous circles are possible as well. So if sites respond to that problem and design themselves a bit better and increase the range of views, considered views that we encounter, then we start having better conversations about how to regulate it. And then with better regulations introduced in campaigning, we are more trusting of our political figures and hold them to a higher standard of behavior than some. We're in a vicious circle now, and getting to that virtuous circle is tricky, but it can build on itself, I hope.
Well, I add to that, because I study traditional media, mm-hmm. that the traditional media norms, which are designed to be attention-getting, are the things that may have led us down this path. You know, soundbite, dramatic, conflict orientation. Mm-hmm. And so these have become the eye catchers. Mm-hmm. And so it's the economic model that kind of made it that way. And so then when you translate, well, Twitter and Facebook and all of these others are also in the economic model, which is you have to have people paying attention in order to get your stock priced a little bit higher. So with that in mind, is it the model that's broken?
Like the model of capitalism is sort of where we got to. Yeah, it seems like these conversations always go there. So I guess I will start answering that question in much the same pragmatic mode that I answered, I think, the optimism pessimism question, which is like, sure, maybe capitalism is actually the root of all evil. Marx was right. But I think that it might be here to stay. And so, you know, again, I think the more interesting and actually more difficult question is, you know, within these confines, what can we start doing to make it better, much as Marx would hate that answer, right? What band-aids can we put on this problem? Again, like, I think that's where a lot of this work is kind of trying to go, right? It's not, Facebook is here, right? And so again, sure, we can criticize that, and I think we should continue doing that, right? If your bottom line is monetizing our identities and our demographic boxes, like, that's maybe a problem, and we can talk about that. But simultaneously, we also need to be talking about what they can be doing in the interim to make those sites not so terrible.
Yeah, and I just add, people are not just going to turn off their computers one day. They need alternatives that they move to. So a lot of people are very frustrated with what they've got. I think many people would pay rather than having purely ad-driven models for some platforms. They would pay to get journalism, to get opportunities to communicate with fellow citizens that is more fulfilling, that doesn't leverage their anger and other emotions as quickly, that doesn't cheapen the conversation. And so I think we need to make sure there are alternatives out there.
And there are. I mean, going back to traditional media, I've been thinking a lot recently about NPR, right? Like, that, again, is a model that does a lot to, like, build local communities, to make sure to contextualize information that can seem very overwhelming when you're just getting it in a straight information overload on Twitter. But again, it's sort of a smaller kind of very cultivated and sort of long sustained kind of news spreading that is connected but distinct and can, again, tailor information a little bit better to the communities of interest that it knows that it serves, without perhaps doing disservices. And so, you know, maybe it needs to be public funded. That's also something that we haven't talked about at all.
But yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, but I do think, again, there are models
out
there.
You guys have it in Canada.
And I don't know that Facebook is going to go, you know, nonprofit or become the state social media. But again, I think that even when we talk about traditional media versus new media, there are, I think, interesting models that we can use even within that.
Yeah, I think the last thing that we didn't get to that I wanted to is about destroying the trust in the very system. In other words, if people don't trust their democratic government or their democratic processes or their sources of information, is that a way of, say, a foreign entity to then destroy really essentially the fundamentals of a country?
Yes, it is. And it is a strategy that some governments have intentionally employed in the past. It's a great way to weaken an opponent, to achieve what you want because they're distracted and turning against each other. And this is both historical, we could have come up with many examples, and it's the way many people describe the information operations of Russia, but it's not only Russia that tries to take advantage of conflicts within different citizenry in other countries in order to get what they want.
Well, thank you both so very much. Chris Tenove and Jennifer Forrestal, it's been a great pleasure to host you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jennifer Forrestal is a professor of political science at Stockton University. Chris Tenove is a postdoctoral research fellow at the Center for Ethics and the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. When we come back, how disasters lift the veil on politics and society. Stay tuned. Thank you. You're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Unprecedented storms and fires are ravaging communities and destroying lives, all while revealing dynamics in society, politics, and power. What are these risks and revelations, and what needs to be done? We're joined by Steve Matthewman and Naomi Zack. Steve Matthewman is a professor of sociology at the University of Auckland. He's the author of Disasters, Risks, and Revelations. Naomi Zack is a professor of philosophy at the University of Oregon. She's the author of The Ethics of Disaster. Welcome to the Scholars Circle, Steve Matthewman and Naomi Zack. It's great to have you both with us. Both of you have been studying disasters, and both of you have said in your respective work about how disasters reveal something kind of underneath the veil. I thought that's a good place to start. Steve Matthewman, what did you mean when you said that?
I think disasters often reveal social arrangements in their clearest possible light. So they tell us who counts, they tell us what counts, they show us the values of the powerful, if you like. So, I mean, I was just thinking about some of the current debates around Hurricane Harvey is one example of that, and the media as agenda setters here. And in terms of who counts, well, Hurricane Harvey is a terrible thing, and of course we need to be covering it in the media. But at the same time, we've got India, Nepal, maybe a third of Bangladesh underwater, 1,200 people plus dead, and probably the indicators I've seen are maybe a fifth of the media coverage. So certainly some people count more than others, and it's also what counts. Hopefully this program will counter the trend, but you know, getting the role of climate change in these so-called natural disasters is somewhat difficult. So I mean, I was looking at media coverage in 2016, for example, of climate change, and it's dropped precipitously in countries like the United States. So there's an organization called Media Matters for America, and they looked at evening newscasts and Sunday shows on ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox News Sunday, and coverage in 2015 was 66% higher. That is to say, in 2016, you know, global warming's not going away, but a 66% drop in coverage. So, you know, some things that are perhaps even of existential importance now are just not being covered. So that's basically what I'm getting at.
So it's also how they're being covered. So for example, they're covering the storms and the fires, by the way, because Los Angeles is on fire.
Sure.
And Oregon is, I understand, got quite a bit of fire, and Montana's on fire.
Yeah.
But are they being covered in a way that people understand the phenomena?
I have a different take on this after starting in about 2005 and making various suggestions, talking to different groups, writing a book, writing articles, etc. I think we have to be very careful about the political appropriation of disaster from either side, because the really pressing aspect of disaster is people die. And the reason people die is there is not adequate preparation. And the reason there's not adequate preparation, if you want to hear something behind or underneath the veil, it's that there's a real existential problem of action, and of action in order to avert a future harm. In other words, everybody starts talking about disaster right after a disaster, especially in a wealthy country, for example, Harvey. But what we lack globally, and this is painfully obvious in parts of the world that are always poor, what we lack is a shared value of preparation. And that's a practical matter. So in a sense, it doesn't really matter whether these disasters are caused by climate change or whether they're completely accidental, or it doesn't matter if they're coincidental or accidental or whatever. The point is people are not prepared for them. And that's why people die in the moment. Now, the other issue of disasters being man-made, human-made, that's obviously true. But that issue is addressed in a moral sense or in an existential sense by good practical preparation, which we don't have. So that's why we not only have disasters, but we have crises, we have emergencies, we have great drama, we have incredible spectacle. Instead of people doing everything they can on a number of different levels to prepare or to better prepare.
Steve Matthewman, do you agree?
It seemed like we were taking issue on some things, but I would have thought the production of vulnerability is itself political. I would have thought how one prepares or mitigates it are also political issues. I mean, one thing I was thinking of is currently there's a terrible hurricane heading towards the United States, Category 5, Hurricane Irma. If you think about the standard pattern of those types of hurricanes, they go directly over Hispaniola, Cuba, Florida. Haiti is always devastated by these. Cuba typically isn't. And then in America, the poor are. Why not in Cuba? Because there is mitigation plans. And what happens in a very simple terms, and the United Nations regard Cuba as being best practice in this regard, is that you've got days of warning that these things are coming. People are taken out of the danger zone. They're taken to shelters. Things that might blow away, big hazards, are secured. Power, gas, electricity is switched off. And then people are only brought back again when it's safe. If you compare that with something like Katrina, where the poor are people that didn't have access to private motor vehicles were left on their own. So yes, it's a mitigation problem, as has been mentioned, but it's also a question of politics and political will, and again, of who and what counts. So, you know, I think within the sociology of disasters, that's a prominent motif. And certainly take the point that we need to think about how some populations and some people are rendered vulnerable. I certainly take the point that often we wait for the disaster, then say, my goodness, let's not let this happen again. But if we're staying on the topics at hand, which are wildfires and hurricanes, we know in both of those cases that global warming exacerbates both. So in the case of hurricanes, higher sea levels because of thermal expansion of seawater, right? So we're going to get stronger storm surges, more ferocious storms cause higher sea temperatures. That's effectively fuel for hurricanes, and warmer air can hold more moisture. And then
this is correct. I don't disagree with any of this. I'm just making a rhetorical point. And that is that the appropriation of disaster, for, in this case, for good cause, would require a more equitable system for minority populations and poor populations, not only in wealthy countries, but globally as well. And that's fine, but I think that that is harder to bring about. In other words, you're not going to get that kind of a social sea change, if you like, more easily then you can save lives in the moment as disasters occur. And even with those kinds of changes, which don't look very plausible in the current political climate that we're all bathing in, even with those changes, you're still going to have disasters without preparation. Let me just complete this notion of preparation. I think that in well-structured societies, there are three levels of preparation. There is individual or family-based preparation, which involves quite prosaically disaster kits. People can afford disaster kits in the United States. Most people don't have them, and they're stranded and they're helpless for want of flashlights, water, whatever their local disaster demands. That's level one. Level two is community assistance. Most first responders, even in the United States, are not going to be officials, they're going to be neighbors. So people need to know their neighbors, at least know them, and have their neighbors know them, so they'll want to help each other in an emergency. And then the third thing is putting some pressure on different levels of government entities to be prepared. And to some extent, if you compare Harvey with Katrina, the officials do learn at tremendous cost of life, really tragic cost of life, they do learn. So anyway, that's the preparation thing. My second idea is a more of a global idea. And I think everyone would be well served if there was an international disaster corps ready to go anywhere in the world, basically on an all hazards approach. And the way to finance that would be through insurance, with wealthier countries picking up some of the tab for poorer countries. So in other words, in some areas, and actually with the worst disasters, you actually see this more and more, there is simply not local assistance available. So assistance has to come in, and it's a very ad hoc series of arrangements to bring in help from other countries or from the Red Cross or from other governments. What we really need at this point is we need a global disaster corps made up of multidisciplinary professionals and practitioners who can get in the air on huge cargo planes that have some kind of aquatic capability and helicopters and so forth and go where the disaster is. But that's not going to happen without some degree of international cooperation. You'd have to set up an international insurance corporation. That's what it would amount to. Everybody would pay premiums, but they wouldn't get the services until an event came up. And probably in the long run, it would be a lot cheaper because quite a bit is spent on humanitarian aid, and humanitarian aid tends to be ad hoc, and it's not always efficient. So what I'm trying to say is, yes, there are the deeper structural issues that are revealed in disaster. And if you think about it for a minute, if it's true that there are these deeper structural issues of indifference, neglect, and apathy toward the poor and toward minorities, a disaster isn't going to change the minds of those in power concerning those inegalitarian structures. If anything, they're just going to yawn wider as long as it doesn't affect them. But so you have that, and you also have this issue of climate change. The problem with climate change is it's been appropriated as an ideological issue. So on both sides, and it's very hard to make any progress because it's no longer a practical matter of what we should do based on our best information, because the so-called climate change deniers have succeeded in tainting any information pertaining to scientific evidence. So you might call that the truth wars. In other words, I think the truth wars and the inequality wars and the cultural wars are best fought on their own ground. And in terms of dealing with disaster, what we're really lacking, what we could actually fulfill, we could do something about this collectively and individually and in small groups, is preparation. We're lacking preparation. A lot of time is being spent in arguing about causes and arguing about inequality and blame. But really, that doesn't give us the boats when a city is flooded. You know, when Harvey was flooded, the officials didn't have enough boats. And they said, well, we'd have to have 350 boats on hand. We don't have them. We couldn't keep them on hand. Why not? You know, why not? That's a good question. So they appealed to the public, and the public was very good. But there is a more efficient way of doing it. So I'm just, you know, I'm just riveted, and that's why I wrote that book, Ethics for Disaster. It was after watching what was happening during Katrina. I'm riveted on the fact that whenever something like this happens, it's like, oh my God, who would have thought? What a surprise. You know, of course we're not prepared. Nobody could have imagined such a thing. Well, we know these things are going to happen. Right. And we know they're going to continue to happen.
So Naomi Zach, let's just let Steve Mathewman respond. Is it really an ideological war on climate change, or do we really need to understand this and get it across to the public?
Well, we absolutely need to understand it. The science isn't ideological. The science is in. It's settled. So the ideology is about what we do about it. And it does involve a strange politics, I think, because, you know, most politics throughout most history has been advocating for the self and your group. It's about getting more recognition and respect. But crucially, it's been about getting more resources as well. Now, we know the problem in countries like the United States and in countries like New Zealand, where I am, the carbon footprint of the average citizen is huge. We're in a way over-consuming. So if we've got to be ethical towards the rest of the planet and the rest of planetary life and other populations outside of these privileged enclaves, we do need to consume less. So that is ideological, and that's also practical, and it's political. We've got to do all of those things. I like the idea of the international core in some ways, because I think often, if you think about these climate-related disasters, we used to call them natural disasters, but and sociologists think there are natural hazards. Whether or not it's a natural disaster or not links to issues that we've already talked about, like levels of preparation, mitigation, response, resourcing, things like that. But how natural nature is these days is a question of some concern, isn't it, given anthropogenic climate change and things like that. So I like the international idea in the sense that often the biggest victims of these disasters are not the perpetrators of them. They're not powerfully industrialized countries are hyper-consumers, that they're quite the opposite. And often they're dealing with the legacies of colonialism and things like that anyway, right? I mean, Haiti is a wonderful case in point there. You know, it was the wealthiest country in the Western Hemisphere, now it's the poorest. And there's an entire colonial legacy, which carries on in neo-colonial forms to this day, that explains that. You know, if you want to see neoliberalism in its purest form, go to Haiti. That's where you'll find it. But, you know, it'd be nice to get some more details on this international corps, because search and rescue search, but they don't rescue. By the time they arrive, you're dead. It's too late. So the first search and rescue teams that came to Haiti were from Finland and places like that. So it gets back to the point that was already made about first responders. The people that will rescue you in disaster are your neighbors, your community members. But actually, I'm a bit more optimistic about the ethical nature of human beings. Complete strangers. There's more than a century of robust empirical evidence from the sociology of disasters, which shows that actually people will even risk their own lives to help anonymous others, to help people they won't know.
People, they're attracted to innocent victims of disaster. They tend to have an aversion to victims of armed conflict. But, you know, I want to push back on the possibility of an international disaster corps, because help from Finland to Haiti took a while to organize. And what I'm talking about is a system of people who could be based throughout the world, who are already getting organized. Say, if it was a Katrina-like, an Irma-like event, they would already be prepared to go there, or they might even already be there.
I mean, Cuba already does that. I mean, they're a self-organ, they're, you know, say that can happen already. I guess the other point I wanted to know about this international corps as well is, you know, I live in New Zealand, in the South Island of New Zealand. We had, you know, serious earthquakes in Canterbury in 2010, 2011. We're a wealthy, privileged, first world country. We're still building back. This rebuild has been slow, painful, deeply problematic, even with all the resources we've got. I don't know enough about New Orleans to think whether those communities think they've built back better or the same. And I understand a lot of those communities are still dispersed and not back in New Orleans.
There's such a thing as disaster capitalism, which Naomi Klein has written about quite comprehensively. And there are some places where there are enough resources left so that it represents an entrepreneurial opportunity. And lots of money is made in the rebuilding effort. Now, the problem with a country like Haiti is there isn't enough left after one of their disasters for anybody to exploit. So that's purely a question of humanitarian aid. You know, Haiti was pledged something like $39 billion after their earthquake in 2005, but it was all sort of ad hoc and piecemeal, and there's an awful lot of disaster tourism. What I'm talking about is I didn't know that Cuba already did this, but Cuba is a small country with, I'm guessing, limited resources. I mean, this would be a multi-billion dollar enterprise financed by insurance premiums. So in other words, every country would pay its premium, regardless of whether or not they had any events needing the disaster corps' assistance. And premiums would be paid in lieu of humanitarian aid after a disaster, although that could be done as well. Premiums would be paid for countries that couldn't afford them. So what this does is it takes quite a lot out of the hands of entrepreneurs, disaster capitalists. It cuts out disaster tourism, cut out all the middlemen and women that distribute disaster aid. And this would have to have multiple bases throughout the world, multiple sources of supplies. It might be divided into different regions. There'd be different specialists for different kinds of disasters. So I'm talking about something very different than one country swooping in and helping another country. The recovery is different from the rescue. I mean, what you want from the rescue is you just want to save lives.
One of the things, Naomi, Zach, that you had written about also in that book that we're talking about was about the difference in governments and how certain governments don't even let international help in. How right. would such a structure even function when you're dealing with an authoritarian right. government?
Yeah, Myanmar for a while wasn't letting people in, and then I think they relented. Well, you know, you try to persuade them. Most governments will let people in. The ones that won't let outside aid in, it's a subject for diplomacy. But none of these structures even exist. There is no entity set up at the moment trying to convince governments that are not likely to let people in ahead of the fact to just let them in if something happens. And then the question is, well, actually, how are they going to stop them? Are they going to shoot down rescue aircraft? I mean, if they're in the middle of a disaster, you know, that's a problem, but that's not the main issue here. I don't think that's the main issue.
It is a side issue. Inside issues do matter too.
Yeah, it is. In other words, it's a problem, but it doesn't really get to the heart of a centrally conceived and run, but locally dispersed disaster rescue corps.
Right. So, and then let's look back at the rebuilding aspect, because this is another element that, and Steve, you brought this up in terms of what's going on in New Zealand specific, but there are issues with power, there are issues with infrastructure, there are issues of doing it in such a way that you're prepared so that it doesn't happen again in that, with that level of destruction, doing things in a more fair, sustainable way. Give us a little bit of feedback in terms of what you've seen in your research.
Well, certainly my research in Christchurch, which is the current research, is in its most preliminary stage, so I can't tell you a lot. But there the feeling is that, you know, there's this maxim, build back better, and everyone thinks, yeah, building back better is a good idea. You know, construction has been such a problem. We've lacked the skilled number of tradespeople to do a build of that level. So the Earthquake Commission is currently reporting something more than 11,000 complaints about substandard building. And anecdotally, I know friends and colleagues that aren't happy with the rebuild of their own house but can't be bothered complaining. They've moved on. Some of them have left the country even, you know, and they're working in North America now and other places. So it's a massive challenge. Some of the big issues are the disconnect between top-down government imperatives and local priorities. Some of the latest polls I've seen have shown that something about 70% dissatisfaction with the recovery priorities. And, you know, a really, really difficult thing to say, and we might say about New Orleans as well as Christchurch, is, you know, should they be there? So the local iwi, local Māori, Ngāi Tahu had always warned European settlers about building in a swamp. It's a floodplain, right, basically. And you now think about the issues we were talking about earlier, like climate change, you know, they're going to be more vulnerable and more at risk. So you need to think very smartly about how you build in green infrastructure, how you do build back better. You know, there are red zoned areas in Christchurch, so there's certain places where they're not going to be built back. But at the moment, there's a deep dissatisfaction with partly the slowness of the rebuild. And I guess that was why I was talking about this international corps. I think I understand it a bit more now. It's about rescuing, saving lives, because actually building, rebuilding cities, communities, you know, that takes years. So that is difficult. But because it is slow, I mean, there are still prospects. One of the things I noticed in Christchurch is that local government and national government were quite good at funding NGOs, community organizations like Greening the Rubble, Gap Filler, and they achieved this global eminence in something called temporary or transitional urbanism, which is, you know, the way in which public life is enhanced by, you know, galleries, community gardens, performance areas, whatever it may be. And I guess the question I'm trying to ask is, what would happen if you let the people in to talk about more enduring urban structures, including infrastructure and electrical power provision and things like that? So I mean, it's a very rare opportunity to rebuild a modern city. I mean, it's only the second time we've had it in this country.
Steve, I'd like to ask you a question about rebuilding. You know, Harvey, Houston, it's a city that sprawled on what was previously very spongy ground. The city itself is something like 600 square miles, the urban area. And the reason there was so much flooding is they've covered it over with concrete. So the water can't be, you see what I'm saying? So the question is, how do you persuade people, governments, individuals, developers, how do you persuade them not to rebuild in areas that are going to just lead to the same thing the next time? How do you change that short-sighted drive to do it all over again to make money?
I think what you actually have to have is really strong, robust legislation, because I've read some of the stuff on Harvey as well, saying that urban sprawl is a huge problem there. The siting is a problem. Concretization is a problem. And that's a massive problem all over the world, actually, channeling water, stopping it absorbing into the ground. But I've also heard there that poor or non-existing zoning laws and some pretty poor insurance practices as well compound it. So I think this is where you really need the state and government to be wrong and actually have very firm legislation so that you don't let people build in floodplains and that you do compel catastrophic insurance, flood insurance things.
In the United States, Trump just allowed to lapse a requirement that new construction take some kind of disaster mitigation into account. So that's no longer there. And we don't have, I mean, in the present political climate, we don't really have a legislature, at least on a federal level, that seems to have a will to require disaster mitigation. I don't think it can happen. I mean, do you think that when you say government, do you mean more local government? Or
I mean specifically national government, so what you'd call federal government. But I think local and regional governments have to do this as well. But, you know, I think this may be compelled on governments in all forms anyway, because you can't afford to keep rebuilding Houston, New Orleans, New York, and add this to the list. So I was trying to think, do some preparation for this talk and look at some of the scientific literature on likelihood of flood events in places like the US. And only this year, there was an article in Environmental Research Letters saying that they would anticipate a 40-fold increase in one in 100-year flood events in coastal US regions by 2050. So, you know, states are going to run out of the money and the capacity and the ability to keep rebuilding if they don't do this. The old adage is true, prevention is better than cure. So I think, in a way, reality, world events will force this upon people to do it, because you simply won't be able to keep building back from destruction.
If we're living in an era of what might be somewhat dysfunctional national government in areas like this, maybe it's going to fall to local government. So some states are much more proactive than other states in terms of emissions controls, in terms of building codes. And we might be seeing an uneven local type of preparation or not.
I can see individual cities and some in the states are already starting to take a lead as environmental champions, as best practice builders and mitigators. So just to get back to what we really do, I mean, I think the two giant elephants in the room, well, one we've exposed and it's climate change. The other one is, to get back to Naomi's points about, you know, populations being rendered vulnerable, and that's the historically unparalleled wealth disparities we face. So the two big things we've got to get to work on is reducing CO2 emissions and redistributing wealth.
Thank you both, Naomi Zack and Steve Matthewman, for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. It's been a great joy to host you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
Steve Matthewman is a professor of sociology at the University of Auckland. He's the author of Disasters, Risks, and Revelations. Naomi Zack is a professor of philosophy at the University of Oregon. She's the author of The Ethics of Disaster. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.